Chapter 11. June, the journalist, and the justification. Today. For Susan Mayo, it was a point of professional pride never to seem intimidated. She'd interviewed presidents, dictators, and Beyoncé. The latter was by far the most intimidating, and she'd always remained composed. She had been nervous on those occasions, sure, but her voice never wavered, and she never said the dreaded, Today would be no different, she thought, as a sharply dressed butler opened the door to the Arizona mansion. June Friday couldn't welcome her personally, explained the butler, because she was making an apple pie in the kitchen. Apple pie. She really was laying it on thick. The atrium of the house was large and white. Tasteful art hung sparingly on the walls, interspersed with a few family photos, mainly of June and her daughters, Anna and Amy. They were famous too, but it was June whom Susan was here to interview. The butler escorted her through the atrium, down a long white hall, decorated exclusively with paintings of peacocks. And then, true to the butler's word, Susan found June chopping apples on a large marble worktop in the kitchen. June Friday was a striking woman. She was pushing 6'1" and had the athletic figure of someone in their late 30s. Not, well, the true age of June Friday, which nobody knew. June looked surprisingly at home in the kitchen. She wore an apron dusted with flour, long blonde hair tied up into a neat practical bun, and the sleeves of her salmon blouse were rolled up to the elbow. "Good afternoon, Miss Mayo. Welcome to my madhouse." June smiled, glancing up from her apples. "Good afternoon, Miss Friday. You have a lovely home." Susan hesitated on the last word. Despite the veneer of domestic bliss, there was something impersonal about it, as if it were a show house, or even a temple. "You've only seen two rooms," June said, "and the upstairs is a mess right now, trust me. Please take a seat," June continued, gesturing to the stools in front of her. Susan sat, making the height difference between the two women even more blatant. June stabbed a chunk of apple with her knife's tip before popping it into her mouth. "Thank you for doing this here. I hate studios. They always make them so cold." "They do it on purpose," said Susan. "It puts the guest on edge." "Is that right?" June asked through a mouthful of apple. "Well, you'd know all about that, wouldn't you? I read some of your pieces in bed this morning. You've got a real knack for this. I bet it drives the guys crazy." "Must be a minefield." She was good. She was very good. Susan felt herself pause. It was only momentary, but it was not a pause of her making. "It's not the easiest work environment, but I think that's why I like it." June pointed the knife at her. "That's what I like to hear. But you've got to be careful. Yes, you have." June withdrew her sabre and began peeling another apple. "Men are told from a very young age that the sky's the limit." Susan noticed the peel was coming off in one long, thin, perfect strip. She was impressed, in spite of herself. "It gives them this sense of overblown optimism. They just assume, even when all the evidence points to the contrary, that everything will just work itself out," June continued, coring the naked flesh. "Head in the clouds." She punctuated each word with the cut of her knife, slicing the apple into perfect eighths. "Us girls, we have to stay a little more grounded. Wouldn't you agree?" The knife was pointing at Susan again. June held it precisely the way Susan held her phone out when questioning a subject. "I'm not sure. Could you elaborate?" Like it or not, this interview had started. "Every day, every hour, every waking moment, we have to plan, we have to think. If I wear this, will he get the wrong impression? That alleyway gets me home 10 minutes faster. Is it worth it?" June talked quickly, dicing the apple with lightning speed. "Don't you worry that you might be in danger of painting us all as victims?" Susan asked. June peered at her with bright hazel eyes. "You got keys in your bag." June scraped the diced apple into a large silver saucepan on the countertop before her. "Yes," replied Susan. She was hesitant and intrigued in equal measure. Where was this going? "Take them out," June ordered. Susan obeyed, retrieving her keys from her bag and holding them out in her hand. "Now." June bent down and disappeared behind the kitchen island, only to reappear seconds later with a jar of brown sugar. "I bet you know exactly between which fingers each key fits best." June tipped the sugar liberally into the pan and began to stir with a long wooden spoon. Susan looked down at her keys. She did. She really did. And she just said, Grounded, thinking, planning, June said with a small smile. "We've been at this game since the dawn of time. But up until now, we've only played defensively, for survival. But what if we went on the offensive?" The two women watched each other over the kitchen island. "You make it sound like a war." "I don't want to fight. I want to win. I want us to win. And not win like men, win like women. And you know the most exciting thing? I can already see it happening." June clicked the ignition and the hob flickered to life. "We're dominating universities, speaking out against our abusers, running for office in record numbers," June said. "Running, but not often winning," Susan countered. "Not yet," smiled June as she put the pan to the flame. Susan saw the older woman's eyes flash. Was it the silver of the pan or the fire from the hob? She couldn't be certain. Beyond the kitchen, Susan could see through to a tastefully decorated open-plan living room. There were two chairs waiting for them as the camera crew busied themselves adjusting the lighting. "Is that what this is about, Miss Friday? Are you thinking of getting into politics?" June laughed. "Oh, God, no! I don't have the temperament for politics." She removed her apron and let her long blonde hair fall gracefully from its bun. "Right. Shall we do this? I've got a world to conquer." And with that, June began striding barefoot towards the living room, leaving Susan to follow on behind. June introduced herself to every member of the crew, promising them a slice of pie after the broadcast. Susan glanced back into the kitchen, where a maid had already taken over the cooking. The two women took their seats opposite each other. Susan watched as June joked with the cameraman about getting her good side. She was struck by how comfortable June was, like a movie star. As their mics were fitted, June's butler came over and whispered something in her ear. Susan caught the briefest flash of a smile she hadn't seen yet on June's face. It wasn't her usual pleasant mask. It had a hunger to it. It was unnerving. A monitor was pushed towards the two women. A short, stout man with a large pair of earphones came over to them. "Susan, your piece is about to start. We'll play your sting, and then we go live. Any questions, Miss Friday?" "No, thank you, darling," June beamed at him. "I feel very safe in Miss Mayo's experienced hands."
"Okay, then. Here we go."
He jogged off.
"Why did you insist on doing this live?" Susan asked, trying to seem matter-of-fact.
"Because I've seen the power of editing, my dear. You could make God himself seem like an asshole."
But before Susan could respond, the screen switched on. A magazine on a tabletop. A picture of June in a white silk shirt on the cover. The headline, "June Friday, Superwoman." A woman of power in every sense of the word, June Friday has made it into the Forbes 500 every year since 2001. Miss Friday has shown that anything her male counterparts can do, she can do better. Susan's own pre-recorded voice filled her ears. Although used to it by now, she always hated the sound of her own voice. She looked over at June, who appeared calm, confident, and ready. She turned her gaze to the monitor, which showed a stock sticker with an upward trajectory. The company name next to the arrow was Friday Limited. Somehow dominating both the world of fashion, a shot of a model walking a runway, and firearms, a shot of a soldier walking down that same runway in full combat gear, a large gun cradled in her arms. Her new venture, the Friday Foundation, works to make the world a better place for young girls everywhere. A shot of June shaking hands with a woman in a headscarf. The camera pulls to reveal that both were on a stage in front of a sea of reporters. Cameras flash. On the wall behind them, a logo, a triple-pointed crown. Above each point was a word. The Friday Foundation.
Oh, I'm so glad you used that shot. June was watching the screen, clearly enthralled. Delightful girl, that one, and been through so much. She's studying right here in Arizona now.
Susan's voiceover continued. A selfless act of philanthropy or a PR stunt for a possible presidential run next year? Then a shot of June standing at a podium, the three-pointed crown logo hovering just above her head. The short, stout man appeared behind the camera and started counting down from five. June turned away from the monitor screen and smiled warmly. It was as if Susan hadn't just publicly doubted her motives. Susan held her gaze. Her heartbeat quickened slightly. It was time. I'm here with Miss June Friday at her Arizona home. The monitor showed a wide shot of the two of them, the word live in the bottom left-hand corner. Susan felt a rush of anticipation. This was her world now. June Friday had stepped into her arena. Miss Friday, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
The pleasure is all mine, purred June. I'm a huge fan of your work.
You have been a divisive character in the past, Miss Friday. Your involvement in the arms trade has made you a target of protest groups. Does this new humanitarian venture signify a change of heart?
Bam! The first shot had been fired. People never expected journalists to come at them so hard, so early on in an interview. Susan leant back in her chair, pleased with herself.
June opened her mouth to speak, then hesitated.
Would she stumble so early on? Susan hoped not. She had 15 more rounds in her.
Susan, I've been around the block. Men will always want to buy a bigger, harder stick. The truth is, I make the best sticks. As I've said time and time again, I am all for common sense gun legislation in the public and private sector. But when you're sending your sons and daughters to defend your country, you're going to want them to have a Friday.
Susan decided to try a different tack.
Let's talk about you. You were just named Cosmo's most fabulous over 50. How does that make you feel?
Charmed.
Any plans for retirement? I hear that your eldest daughter Anna is taking on a lot of the day-to-day runnings of things.
On the monitor, a picture showed June with her daughters at a black tie event. June wore a sparkling gown. Anna, a sensible but stylish pantsuit, glasses, brunette hair worn high, and Amy, a tasteful cocktail dress, her long red curls hanging loose.
I'm not going anywhere just yet, said June, her face tightening.
But yes, I am very proud of my daughters. You're a hero to single mothers everywhere, and yet rumors about the identity of your children's father persist.
Susan pushed a strand of hair behind her ear.
Any chance you'll give me the exclusive of a lifetime and tell me who the father is?
Susan knew this was a long shot, but she hoped she might get something out of June's deflection.
June looked up to the ceiling. She appeared to be pondering her answer, and Susan's heart leapt. Suddenly, June was looking straight at her, her hazel eyes blazing.
My ex-partner was an ambitious man, said June, who got too big for his boots. Her smile had vanished. I know a lot of impressionable young women watch your show, Susan. That's why I agreed to do this interview. So let me be clear. A relationship should not have a hierarchy. The day your partner acts like they're above you or puts you on a pedestal, that's the day you tell them to fuck off.
Susan chanced a glance at her director, whose eyes were wide. This was great TV, but terrible for sponsors.
All they're trying to do is to stop you looking them in the eye from seeing them for what they truly are. June's cheeks were a little flushed. Her finger had been stabbing the air in front of her. It reminded Susan of the kitchen knife, though somehow this finger felt more threatening. Susan leant forward, and June caught herself. The colour faded from her face, her finger lowered. I apologize. After all these years, he can still rattle my cage.
No need to apologize, said Susan, trying to hide her disappointment. She couldn't complain. She'd got the sound bite. The curse could always be bleeped out. It would blow up online either way.
It was time to throw the dog a bone. Let's talk about the Friday Foundation. What's it all about?
June looked relieved at this new line of questioning. Her eyes, which had burned so brightly only moments before, returned to a low simmer. The Friday Foundation is a philanthropic organization that tackles problems faced by women around the world. The idea came to me while I was in church a few months ago. There was a young girl, Julia, about, 22, and she was praying out loud. Her home life was rough, and she was just asking for a way out. And I realized, June, you have the power to answer this girl's prayers, so I did. She now has her own place to live, a good job, and a future. And out of that transformative experience, the Friday Foundation was born, answering the prayers of women and young girls everywhere. Susan was impressed. She'd heard a lot of stump speeches in her time, but June said everything. Religion, feminism, a young girl saved. This would play well with both sides.
So you're saying we should all pray to you? Susan asked with a smile.
Not exactly, June returned the smile. They continued to talk. Susan kept seeing if she could reignite the fire from earlier, but for the rest of the interview, June Friday remained composed and on point.
Well, Miss Friday, thank you for answering my questions this afternoon. Before we go, we've just got time for the Susan Shines questionnaire. We do it with all of our interviewees.
Susan hated doing these, but it was described to her by her social media manager as buzzable content, whatever that meant, and she had to keep her happy. She half expected June to refuse, but June waved a gracious hand, giving the green light to continue.
Who is your feminist hero?
Boudicca.
What's your deadly sin?
Greed. I thought that would have been obvious.
What's your guilty pleasure?
Boxing. I enjoy watching boxing.
If you could be any age, what would it be?
Exactly the age I am now.
And finally, how do you want to be remembered?
June paused. I know that a lot of people will probably remember me as that ball-breaking bitch, and I'm fine with that. But I suppose I see the Friday Foundation as a positive legacy for me to leave behind while I knock hard on the gates of heaven, martini in one hand and a loaded Friday in the other.
That evening, June sat in her living room on a white leather Chesterfield, enjoying a delectable slice of apple pie. She was happy with how the day had gone. The interview had done very well on social media. Both her and hashtag Friday Foundation were trending. An adequate substitute for the once bountiful animal sacrifices burnt in her name. But this was just the beginning. This was the eve of the Second Great Revolution. And unlike her fallen brothers, heaven didn't even know this one was coming. Her long-estranged husband would be shocked and a little hurt. He had been great once, but he'd rested on his laurels these last two millennia, just stayed sat in his chair, watching and smoking that infernal pipe of his. It was time for a change of management, a more interventionist order. Sometimes the old ways were the best. Everything was falling into place. All of her daughters were by her side. Having Anna, the eldest, at her right hand was a relief. June had been worried that she wouldn't join her in the takeover, as she had always loved her father so. But she was a creature of reason, and after June had explained the logic of her plan, Anna had become her envoy, travelling all over creation, amassing her army, an army now ready to march. And her youngest daughter, the beautiful but broken Amy, had done her part. Heaven had lost its greatest defender. Amy needed to stay broken just a little while longer. In order to keep her that way, Adam could not be allowed to find Eve just yet. If he did, and first love was restored, June would lose her hold over Amy, and without her, June knew she had no hope of taking heaven. June had successfully kept Eve in fetters for so long and thwarted Adam's attempts so many times that there was no doubt she could hold him back once more. And when it was all over, she could free them both, the first woman and her daughter, and allow Adam to finally find Eve. Then she would rule. Rule everything. With love and fear. But now she needed Diana, her middle daughter, to find Adam. It was so good to have her back. The world didn't know of Diana. She didn't go to the parties or the clubs. Her photographs didn't appear on Google search. She was the hunter and, as the butler had whispered, was on Adam's heels. Diana wouldn't let her down. June finished the last bite of pie. Nothing had ever tasted so sweet.
You've been listening to Evergreen, Chapter 11, written by Sam Russell and read by Catherine Russell. If you enjoyed this chapter, wherever you're listening, please subscribe, give us a rating and review so we can get this story into more people's ears. And if you really enjoyed it and want to support this project, you can do so on our Ko-fi page. All the details are available on our Twitter account, @EvergreenBook1. The next chapter comes out on November 1st. Thanks for listening.